and I'm at the home of Eileen Songstead. This is the oral history project for Dr. Hansen's 490 Senior Research Seminar in the spring of 1994. Hi. Okay, we're talking about the American Japanese evacuation. And just to get us started, just so we can get to know, make sure we know what time frame you were in then, just tell just what was like your family background and where were you living and where were you, where are your ancestry from and all that.
Okay, well, I was living in Moscow, Idaho at the time, and I was newly married this period of time. My background is mostly Norwegian and some Irish and British Isles and so forth. My mother was Norwegian and my father was the British Isles side of the family. And I got married when I was 21. So, and that was in 1940. So we were married about a year and a half, not quite, when Pearl Harbor came along. Mm-hmm. And as I said, we were living in Moscow, Idaho at the time. Of course, there was a lot of war already going on in Europe and so forth. Mm-hmm. And everybody was very concerned because we were at an age when many of our friends would be going to war, and perhaps even my husband at the time. But it was a very scary, uncertain time of life, and so when Pearl Harbor struck, we were really stunned because mm-hmm. we weren't expecting it.
What were you doing for a living then?
Well, I was working for my dad, and I had finished 3.5 years of college, and then I got married, much to my folks' surprise, and fully intended to go back to school, which I did later on in life. I did go back to school and finish and got my teaching credential and so forth. But at that time, it seemed to me like it was more important to get married and be with my husband than to finish school.
Uh-huh. What did your husband do?
Well, he had worked his way through school as sort of helping in a shoe repair. Mm-hmm. And so, at that time, he had opened his own business, and it's called Les's Shoe Fixery in Moscow.
That was good.
Yeah.
So, what made you decide to move to California?
Well, he's always been interested in airplanes, and he'd taken some flying lessons in Idaho. And it was called a CPT training, a civilian pilot's training course, and it was offered through the university. He was also going to school there at that time. And so he had heard that if you had, you know, a certain number of hours of college and so forth, that they would pay you to take this civilian pilot's training course. And, of course, he was very interested in airplanes, so he signed up immediately. Mm-hmm. And they paid for all of his training and his back and forth to the airport and everything. So he really got a very good training course.
Right.
So then they also noticed that there was a notice at the post office that anybody who had a pilot's license could apply for Civil Aeronautics Administration to be a tower operator.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, this really appealed to him, you know, so he applied for that and took the test and passed it. And then they sent him to California for training, and that's how we got to be in California.
Oh.
So he was sent to Santa Monica for training for 2 months, and then I later followed him. And when he finished that, he was sent to Long Beach in the control tower at Long Beach Airport, and that's where he started. The CAA eventually became Federal Aeronautics Administration, and he was with them for 31 years.
Wow. When the war first broke out, before the Pearl Harbor incident, what changes happened in your life? Like, terms of the community and things like that?
Well, of course, when the war broke out, my husband had been in the cavalry unit at the university, which was it was similar to the ROTC type of thing. And he preferred horses, so he liked to go to the cavalry. So, but then the cavalry unit was changed to an armored vehicle unit, and they were sent overseas. The reason my husband didn't go was he had been injured in some cavalry training, and it broken his knee, so he was not able to go with the unit, thank goodness, because most of them did not come back. They were in the very beginning of the Pacific War, and many of them didn't return. So I'm thankful that he had the broken knee. At the time, I wasn't so excited about it. So that's why he wasn't sent over there. And then when he went to work for the CAA, well, of course, he handled mostly military planes in Long Beach, at the Long Beach Airport, because that's where all the planes that were made in the area were tested there. So most of them were military planes, like Burr Douglas and Lockheed and North American, and they were all making military planes at that time.
So did you have to change your lifestyle at all with the war? I mean, was there, could you tell that you were in the middle of a war, or were things just seem like mostly same as usual?
Definitely. There were changes all around us. And for instance, there was a radar training school at the University of Idaho, which was in Moscow while we were still there, and many naval, young naval people were sent there for this radar training. And of course, some of them met local girls and married them. You know how that goes in the wartime. In fact, my cousin Wanda married one of them. Anyway, of course, they didn't marry until much later on, but that's where they met. And there was a naval training base at Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, called Farragut, which was it was inland, but it was such a huge lake that they had a naval training base there. Mm-hmm. And of course, there were many, many military people involved in that. So we had military people all around us in Moscow and the area, even though we were far from any big military base, you know, and so forth. So yes, it made a big change in our lives, because of course, the papers were full of the war news, and everybody was kind of wondering what was going to happen to their lives at that point, because it was making a big difference.
Right.
And a lot of our friends were going in the service, and made a big difference in their lives, of course. You know.
So, how did people actually feel about the issues of the war? Were they very...
Well, of course, for a long time, you know, when Germany started invading other countries and so forth, we hoped to stay out of it, you know.
Right.
And, of course, we hoped to stay out of the whole conflict, but we eventually were drawn into the European side of it. And then when Pearl Harbor came along, why then, of course, we were in full blown. And, of course, a lot of the big companies started making things for the war effort, and so civilian products became very scarce, like shoes, and for instance, appliances. You couldn't even buy an appliance, because everybody that was making appliances had very little on stock, and so they had to ration it to people who were maybe getting into a brand new house, which was sort of unlikely at the time, or an apartment that had no appliances. They had to have a ration number in order to buy an appliance. Mm-hmm. And when we came to California, we rented a brand new apartment in Bellflower that, of course, had no appliances in it, but they had a number where if you were going to be living in that house, you could buy a refrigerator, for instance, which is what we bought.
Mm-hmm.
And but you couldn't buy appliances during the war. Of course, there were no televisions at that time.
Right.
But you had to have a reason for buying that type of thing. And of course, like shoes, many of the shoe companies were making military shoes and military things. So they rationed everything. They rationed food, they rationed clothing, shoes especially, and everybody was issued a ration book. Mm-hmm. And you had so many ration coupons a good each month.
Right.
Now, like shoes, you only had so many a year.
Mm-hmm.
And but if you, you know, eventually, like my husband and I, we had our first child, and she was issued a ration book. Of course, she didn't need any shoes for quite a while, so that gave us a little extra on that score. But it made a big difference in our lives.
Right. Right. How did that affect your husband's shoe business?
Well,
was he more into
in the meantime, his shoe business burned down, so that that took care of that.
Oh no!
So of course, then when he was sent to California and with the job with the CAA, why it worked out fine.
Wow. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
So what was it like right before Pearl Harbor happened and the day of Pearl Harbor? Do you remember?
Well, of course, we'll never forget the day of Pearl Harbor.
Now, did you find out actually on the day of Pearl Harbor, or did you not find out until the next day? Or
no, we found out right then, because we were in Moscow at that time, as I said, and it came over the radio that Pearl Harbor had been bombed by the Japanese. And of course, we all were very close to the radio all day long, wondering what was happening. And it wasn't very long before the President Roosevelt came on and talked about, you know, they called it a dastardly act and so forth. And, mm-hmm. and you know, at the same time that this happened, the Japanese envoy was in Washington saying that we're going to work out our differences and everything was going to be fine and bowing and scraping and smiling, and
mm-hmm.
and everybody hoped that was true.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, then all this time they were on their way, you know, to bomb Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a big shock when that happened. And they caught us completely off guard over there, and you know, it was a disastrous attack on Pearl Harbor. So, yeah, we were very, very much interested and listened very carefully particularly that whole day when it happened, and because they were talking about the terrible casualties and the sinking of the battleships and so forth, and it was real scary.
How did that change people's opinion about being involved in the war?
Well, they were ready to go. You know, everybody was ready to enlist and go to war and take care of the whole situation,
mm-hmm.
which in their minds was not going to be such a long affair as it was. But of course, it was a very disastrous war.
Now, were there any Japanese living in Moscow when you were there?
No, there weren't.
No?
There weren't. I've talked to some of my friends who were in Southern California at that time, and of course there were a lot of Japanese in California.
Right.
And there were a lot of Japanese on Terminal Island, which is a naval base right here, you know, off of Long Beach.
Uh-huh.
And they were very concerned because they didn't know whether they would be signaling the enemy and so forth if they came. And there was a Japanese submarine that surfaced off our coast. So apparently, you know, there were a lot of Japanese living in Hawaii at the time of Pearl Harbor too,
right.
And they thought that, and they did find some cases where the Japanese had signaled, the Japanese planes came in and so forth, and so they got very paranoid about Japanese people, even though they were most innocent. You know, at the time, you get very nervous and you take every precaution that you think you'll take, and that's where the Japanese occupation, you know,
right.
came about.
So when you were getting ready to move to California, did it ever cross your mind that you might be living with Japanese?
Never even thought about it.
And when you got here, were there any Japanese still in the area?
Even remember that there were. I think that they probably were in the process of moving them or had already done so.
And you got to California in April of 41?
No, I think it was 42. 42, and it was June when I came.
Okay, June.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there were really no Japanese still in your community at all?
Well, I don't remember that there were.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you remember hearing about the evacuation?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
And what did you hear about?
Well, just that they had were relocating all the Japanese so that they wouldn't be in a position to help if they were invaded here. They were very concerned that we were going to be attacked by the Japanese here. And they had blackouts here, and when we drove at night, we had to, when we had headlights of our car, you had to tape the top part of the headlight so that they wouldn't show, you know, too much. And they'd have an air raid once in a while, and everybody had blackout, and the blackout curtains on your window, so that...
And you did this, too?
Yeah, when we came to California.
And how did they notify you of the blackout?
Well, they had a loud siren, this particular type of siren that would sound. And when you heard that, you knew that it was a blackout time.
And how often did you do this?
Not very often, thank goodness. Not very often.
And what was your feeling when you heard the siren go off?
Well, you know, you were really kind of frightened because you didn't know exactly what was coming. You know, it might be an air attack. It might be, you didn't know.
But there never was anything.
No, there
was. It just was.
Uh-uh.
And how long, was it just overnight? You just kept the...
Well, usually it was just an hour or two before they were able to sound it all clear. So
that must have really frightened people.
It was. It was real scary.
Really frightened people.
Yeah.
So do you, during the evacuation, the time when the Japanese were no longer actually in the communities of California, do you ever remember hearing about their life in the camps, or?
It was just like, as far as I was concerned, it was just like they just completely disappeared.
Yeah.
You didn't really hear too much about it.
Huh. I've been reading the press telegram at this time, and I'm surprised that there were no, in all the issues that I've looked at, there was never a picture of any Japanese, never a wedding announcement, even a death announcement, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any idea why?
I don't know, unless they were just trying not to mention the Japanese too much. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, a lot of the young Japanese men who were relocated joined the army and were very brave and did a lot of good. A lot of them joined the army, the United States Army,
right,
or a branch of the service of some kind.
Right. There's a lot of people who feel that the main reason they were relocated was not because of their danger to America, but just in terms of racism. Do you feel that was played a role at all?
I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I always thought that it was because of security reasons more than racism.
Do you feel that people just in general had racist feelings towards the Japanese, or unfriendly feelings?
I think there were many people who did, and unfortunately, even after the war was over, there were many servicemen who returned who had a definite racist attitude toward the Japanese, partly because some of them had endured mistreatment at the hands of the Japanese as prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether this has any bearing on it or not, but my husband worked with a man in the tower in Los Angeles after the war was over, who had been a prisoner of war of the Japanese and had had his leg amputated for no reason, and he could not stand the sight of a Japanese because he felt so ill toward them.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess maybe is understandable, I don't know.
Right. Were you, when the evacuation ended, did you find a number of Japanese coming back into the community?
I think it took a while for them to filter back.
Right.
I don't really remember it, you know, too clearly about that part, but of course, they did come back and settle again and did very well. I think that a lot of people started thinking maybe it was not a very fair thing to do to relocate them when many of them had to leave their businesses. When they came back, they had to start over from scratch, which didn't seem fair. They were loyal to the United States, and it took a long time for them to get back to a normal life.
Right. One of the most phenomenal things about the evacuation is just that looking back through it, there was actually never any evidence, and the government knew that there was never any evidence that any Japanese were being disloyal or were giving information back to Japan, and yet they decided to evacuate them anyway. And although most of the public does not realize this, and they felt that it was mostly for security and mostly because there was a potential threat of the Japanese actually doing something against the United States, people have believed in the fact that the government was doing the right thing. Knowing that the government knew that there was no real threat of any American Japanese or no known American Japanese mm-hmm. that had done anything even remotely wrong. How does that make you feel about the fact that they did relocate over 110,000 people?
I think it's sad. I think it's sad, and I think probably because of the hysteria at the time, and of course the media plays up this type of thing as it still does today. I think that's probably why it all was carried out. But I think that people feel really bad, and I feel bad about it too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that there's much you can do about it at this point.
No, yeah.
But it was unfair.
Right.
It was.
Right. A part of my thing in this study is how the media did affect what people thought, and did they make the public feel one way or feel another way? And so you would think that the media definitely plays a role in.
Oh, I think it plays a big role. I think, you know, when you keep hearing about it and you read about it and so forth, it just magnifies the whole thing, just like
right.
things today do, you know, like different issues today that are played upon by the media over and over and over and over again. It just is ingrained in people after a while.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. Now looking back at what happened and thinking of the present time, do you think that something like this could happen again in the United States, a group of people being evacuated due to are going to war with their country?
I don't know. I suppose it could happen. I know, of course, we have television, which is more explicit
mm-hmm.
form of the media than we had at that time. And I suppose it's possible. I hope not.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
We have so many different refugees and so forth in this country now from other parts of the world that are having problems, you know. I suppose it's possible.
People have said that at a time back when World War II happened, people were more trusting that the government would do the right thing. Do you feel that's more true than it is now?
It probably is. It probably is more true than at that time. Simply because also communication was not at that time what it is today, you know, because of the television media and so forth. We really just had the radio and the newspapers to
right.
to inform us. TV is a big boon as far as educating the public, good or bad, you know.
Right. Did you ever notice any, when the Japanese came back into the community, did you ever notice if they were welcomed, or did they mainly stick to themselves? Did they form their own groups, or did things change at all in terms of them being a part of the community?
Well, I suppose the older generation stuck together pretty much. I would think they would anyway, but I think they probably did. But of course, by the time the war was over, I think people were well aware that many young Japanese men had joined the service and had fought for their country and done as well as anybody could possibly do. And I think that people were beginning to feel differently towards, you know, toward them and welcome them back, just like they did everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
For myself, I certainly felt that way.
Right. When the issue of the redress came about, do you remember how people felt about that?
About what?
The redress when any living Japanese who had been in the camps were given $20,000.
I think they probably deserved it.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember too much about that.
Okay.
There were some people who resented it.
Uh-huh.
But there's always going to be somebody who resents something like that. I think most people felt that it was an unfair thing to them to happen.
Right. Good. Is there anything else you can that you remember about the Japanese being in the United States at that time, or how people felt, or what they thought?
No, like I say, you know, there really weren't any Japanese in Moscow when we were up there, of course. And there, I think we only had two Chinese families in our town. It was just a little farming community, so you know, but the university was there, but most of the kids who came to the university lived in Idaho.
Right.
And so we didn't have any racial type of thing there at all.
Mm-hmm.
We had two black families who lived there, and they were well thought of in the community. Everybody liked, you know, everybody got along pretty well. There was no racism there.
Mm-hmm. Did their feelings change at all throughout the war, do you think? Or do you think most people just...
You mean up there?
Yeah. Or in California?
Well, I don't know. California is a whole different situation than Idaho.
Uh-huh.
But I think people generally accepted everybody, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What would you say were the main differences between life in California and life in Idaho?
Well, life in Idaho, certainly much more laid back than California.
Uh-huh.
California is, well, of course, there's a lot more people here,
right.
And traffic's much more congested and so forth. But and Idaho is just, as I say, a very laid back area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
and has it continued to be the same amount of difference?
I think they probably still are. They have a lot more crime up there than they used to have, like every place does.
Mm-hmm.
And they even have a drug problem up there, which was surprising to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it doesn't matter where you go, you're going to find the same problems.
Right.
To a lesser degree, maybe, than some other place. But
okay. Well, let's take a break so I can go over my... Okay, I was just getting ready to talk about the economy. What was it like tracing it from right before the war, throughout the war, to the after the war?
Well, before the war, I don't remember that the economy was in any bad shape or anything like that, but when the war started, of course, the economy really boomed. You know, they were busy building everything, warships and airplanes, and of course they had to outfit all the military, all the different branches of the military, and everything was just booming. And people who lived in Southern California, especially which where I was at that time, by then, you know, they were going to work in the defense plants, and it was very easy to get a job, except that you had to go through a very strict ritual to work in a defense plant. You had to make an application, you had to take a test, and from that test they would place you in the department they thought that you would be the most valuable to that.
What was the test like?
I went down to they had a employment office in downtown Long Beach, and we lived in Long Beach at that time, and I went down and made out an application, and they gave me this test, and it was mostly some math, just a general intelligence test.
Mm-hmm.
And from the test they thought that I belonged in the payroll department.
Mm-hmm.
At Douglas, and so that's where then they sent me from downtown out to the Douglas plant.
Mm-hmm.
And out there I had to take a physical, and I had to go through another little screening and so forth. It took all day to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't told Les that I was even going to do it.
Oh, really?
So he comes home that night, and there's no Eileen there.
Oh. Why hadn't you told him?
Well, I don't know. I just got the idea, I think I'll go down and apply for a job,
uh-huh.
Because I was sitting in an apartment, and
uh-huh.
I was kind of dull. So I did that, and they sent me out to the plant. I had no idea I'd be gone all day.
Right.
And it was 9 o'clock by the time I left the Douglas plant. And by that time, of course, I had my badge to get in the plant. And I had all the papers that I needed to go start work.
Of
course, you had to have, they had very tight security in the defense plants.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to open your lunch pail or your sack or whatever when you came in. You had to have a special badge in order to get in. And you even went through a security gate, like you do at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And because they didn't want any sabotage, of course.
Right.
And I went to work in the payroll department, and what I did, everybody had to punch a time card,
mm-hmm.
When they came to work, and there were three shifts, a day, a swing, and we called it a graveyard shift, which
mm-hmm.
was midnight to 8 or whatever in the morning. When I came in at 8 o'clock, I worked the day shift, I came in at 8 o'clock, but by that time, the cards from the midnight shift were there, and
mm-hmm.
of course we had to go through those. And we didn't have the equipment that they do now, so we went through and totaled up all the hours that each pay card had,
wow.
Mm-hmm. And then they went on to what they call the rate file, and those people put the rate of pay that each person had, and then they went back to accounting, and that's where they were put through the machine and auditing and so forth, and that's all the paychecks were made up, and
right.
It was really quite a complicated process.
Hmm.
And in my little section of payroll, I think there were probably half a dozen of us that worked and put in doing the time cards.
Uh-huh.
Of course, there were a lot of time cards to do.
Right.
Yeah. And at that time, a lot of women went to work actually working on the airplanes themselves. And I remember there was a song that came out called Rosie the Riveter.
Uh-huh.
And it was a little song about a lady who went to work in the airplane plant and with the riveting gun and the mask and all this kind of stuff, So everybody used to tease everyone who worked in the defense plant, "Oh, you must be Rosie the Riveter." Which I wasn't, of course. But it was kind of fun working there, and the pay was good, and you had about 48 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually brought in, for the noon hour, they'd bring in different entertainment, and you could go out and watch the entertainment. I remember they brought in different movie stars, like Loretta Young was there one time, and
mm-hmm.
different stars, and you'd go out and watch them. It was kind of fun to do,
I bet.
And yet you were helping the war effort, too.
Right. So what did your husband say when you came home that night?
Well, he was thankful to see me. And when I came out of the plant that night, the buses had stopped running,
Oh.
And so I didn't have any way to get back into Long Beach because this was quite a ways out of town.
Uh-huh.
And so, of course, there were a lot of people leaving that were out there for the same reason I was.
Right.
And so this one couple asked me, do you need a ride into Long Beach? Of course, I didn't know them from Adam.
Uh-huh.
But they'd been through you know, getting right. employed too, so I figured it was safe. So anyway, they took me home.
Oh, wow. what do you think about your new job?
Well, he was delighted. We were sort of living on a shoestring at that point. So he was delighted because I was going to be bringing in a paycheck.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Yeah. When he was working at the Long Beach Tower, did he have any more information about the war or what was going on?
Well,
did you feel like the war knew more?
The ferry command was situated there at Long Beach, and all the planes that that came in there had to have a certain number of hours on them before they could be released to the Air Force or the Navy or whichever they were going to go. And then the ferry command would ferry these planes to whatever base they were going to. Right. So it was a very busy airport at that time because, well, you can imagine the Boeing and Douglas and Lockheed and North American, all those planes came through the Long Beach Airport to the ferry command. So you see, it was a really busy time.
Wow.
And he enjoyed every minute of it because he loved airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
He liked the traffic control part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked shifts also. He would work swing and day and midnight shift, called it that, the graveyard shift, which,
right.
And he would alternate. He'd have swing, then he'd have days, then he'd have, you know, the graveyard
days.
Shift.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
When you
it was
came
kind of an interesting time.
I bet. When you came from Moscow to California, how did you get here?
That was another interesting way. Les came down on the bus. He took the bus down. So, and I was going to come down on the train. So I was saving my money to come down on the train or the bus, one or the other, whichever was fastest for me. And so I was, at that time, then I had changed jobs, and I was working at a five and dime place, and it was called Ben Franklin's, and I was doing the bookwork.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sitting up in the office doing the bookwork one day, and I heard this lady come in the store and asked one of the clerks, she says, I wonder if you know anybody that would like a ride to California. She said, I'm up here to see my husband who's in this radar training up here. And she said, I came up to see him. And she said, I am interested in finding some people to ride to California with me and share the expenses of the trip. So my ears perked right up, and I thought, oh, I wonder, maybe I could ride to California with her.
Right.
So I go down and I talk to her, and she said this was on a Friday or something. She was leaving Monday morning to come back to California, and she was coming to Long Beach.
Oh,
well,
wow.
Of course, my husband was in Santa Monica, which is right there,
right.
You know, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is a way for me to get to California and not
right.
spend as much money and
right.
and so forth. So I talked to her about it, and she said that she was leaving, and I think it was something like $25 that she wanted or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, I think maybe I'd be interested in that. And I gave her my phone number and everything, because I was staying with my folks then, because Les
right.
already lived. So I went home and told my folks about it, and I'm surprised that they even were interested in letting me go with a perfect stranger, you know, driving off into the sunset. And so they thought, well, I guess maybe it'd be all right. And so I said, okay. So she called. I told her, yes, I would be interested in going. So she drives up Monday morning in it wasn't a convertible, it was a coupe, but it had a rumble seat in the back, you know. She had an elderly woman with her and another young man with her, about my age. I didn't have much luggage. My folks were going to just send my luggage on. So anyway, I took off in the rumble seat with this young man and this elderly lady and the other lady in the front seat.
Oh,
and
wow.
away we went.
And
that was quite a trip because her car wasn't in very good shape. We had a lot of car trouble. We had I don't know how many flat tires. And tires were scarce, so you had to buy retreads, you know, or fix up the old ones and so forth. And it was really quite a trip. And we didn't stop. We just drove, you know, steadily. And the boy, we changed off driving. But I tell you, I was glad to get to Santa Monica.
I bet. How long did it take you?
Well, I don't know. Let's see. We left on a Monday morning, and I think we were there Wednesday because we had to stop and get tires, and we had to stop and get the car fixed and different things. So it took a while.
Wow. That must have been a big change, though.
It was a big change.
All in 3 days. Yeah. With your tires and everything along the way.
Yeah.
Well, what did you think when you first got to California? What were your first
Of course, I was happy to go to California. I had been through California with my parents when I graduated from high school. We took a trip and we went all through Yellowstone and down through Nevada and came up through California. And I love California. I especially like San Diego. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to go back to San Diego. Never did make it, but I'm close. And so I was delighted when Les was sent to California because I always wanted to go back there. And then when he was assigned in California, that was even better. You know? So, I love California.
Good.
Been here ever since.
Good. Let's see. Did you keep anything from the time of World War II? Any?
You know, I had some old ration books, and I had and I was looking for those this morning. And I thought, give those to you, and I can't imagine where they still had some stamps left in them.
Right.
And I also had a you could buy defense stamps, and when you filled up a book, then you got a bond, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And I also had one of those that was had a few stamps in, and I was thought, well, that'd be great for you, you know, include your report, but I can't imagine whatever happened to them.
Right. When did the rationing stop?
Not till the war was over.
And then did it just fade out, or?
Well, even with the rationing stamps, you were lucky to be able to spend the stamps, because if you weren't at the market, like for instance, when the margarine or you know was rationed, flour was rationed, meat was rationed, and if you thought, well, there's going to be a shipment coming in, if you weren't there with your stamps when it came in, you didn't get any. It was gone.
Did you ever wonder how they were feeding all the Japanese in the camps?
Well, of course, the government was doing that.
Right.
So,
I mean, they had 3 meals a day.
Oh, sure.
Stuff. People never wondered, thought that maybe they were getting more than.
No, I don't think so.
Other people are getting.
I don't think so. You know, we still had plenty to eat and all that, but we just didn't have a variety and, and so forth.
Right. So then after the war, just. Sort of.
Everything just kind of filtered back to normal, you know. Mm-hmm. Took a while, of course.
Right. Right. Wow. Well, I think that is all I have to ask you. Thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome.